more innocent civilians. Our top story, the Syrian army says that it has inflicted heavy losses and casualties on foreign-backed terrorists on the outskirts of the northwestern cities of Aleppo and Idlib. The Syrian army says it has killed and injured hundreds of terrorists. The army added that it had also destroyed dozens of armored vehicles and shot down 17 drones. It said Syrian forces had repelled a major offensive on Aleppo and regained control of areas that had been seized by the terrorists. The army stressed that it will continue to reinforce its ranks to foil the foreign-backed aggression. Earlier, terrorists launched artillery strikes against Aleppo, targeting a student housing. The attack left 4 civilians dead and several others wounded. Syria has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy for over a decade. Ibrahim Wahdi is joining us now from the Syrian capital, Damascus, to bring us up to speed on the recent tensions there. Ibrahim, what do you have to share with us? We know that this is a very fluid situation. What are the latest updates?
Yes, Badia. As you mentioned, the terrorist groups located in Idlib and the Aleppo Western countryside have launched a major attack on the positions of the Syrian army and the safe towns and villages in Aleppo countryside. We need to mention that this is a blatant violation of the de-escalation agreement signed by Russia and Turkey on March 5, 2020. Russia as a guarantee of the Syrian side, Turkey as a guarantee of the terrorist side. Pardon. Dozens of explosions also have been reporting of walkie-talkies and pagers recently. Now, this is a new update. Among the Syrian Arab Army soldiers, like, if you remember the pager accident incident in Lebanon, this indicates a direct involvement of the Israeli Mossad in these attacks. Now, currently, fierce clashes are taking place in Aleppo western countryside, while the terrorists managed to breach the city from the west into 3 neighborhoods, Halab al-Jadida and Al-Hamdaniya and Salah al-Din. They are now on the outskirts of Salah al-Din at Salah al-Din roundabout. They're trying to make their way to the eastern side of the city while facing fierce resistance from the Syrian Arab Army and the allied forces. These terrorist organizations also, that's something important. These terrorist organizations are groups of Turkish-backed terrorists, Turkistani Party, the Al-Nusra Front, aka HTS or Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. They are located in the rural areas of Aleppo and Idlib, and they have launched their wide-scale attack depending on large numbers of terrorists using medium and heavy weapons, suicide bombers and advanced drones. As you mentioned, the Syrian Arab Army said that they have they have inflicted heavy losses in both personnel and equipment on the attacking organizations. We're talking about something like over 500 killed and many other wounded, and it's continuing to engage the terrorist groups using various types of firepower in coordination with friendly forces. Now the situation in rural in Aleppo countryside, the Syrian Arab Army has reclaimed several towns in the countryside of Aleppo and secured the part of the highway, the M5 highway, while it's still closing it because the clashes are very close to the highway of Aleppo, of Aleppo Damascus Aleppo highway. The threat to Aleppo now persists more from the south, specifically near the villages of Al-Ais and Tal-Ais, because it's a high hill that can oversee Aleppo itself. Now the Syrian Arab Army is maintaining control of the hill at the moment and defending it with all its power. The hills of Anadan, north of Aleppo, are still under control, and while the town itself is remain in the hands of the militants so far, but it would be easily reclaimed. because we have the health. The Syrian army still controls the health in the northern countryside. Now, huge military enforcement have arrived and still arriving, actually, to the western countryside of Aleppo, and the towns of Nubal and Zahra have been fortified to ensure its resistance. The army is still in the preparation phase at the moment. We're still the army. We've witnessed this before. The army contained in the first phase the attack as much as possible, and then establish strongholds. Then it will launch. Then it will launch a counterattack to reclaim the city. It is expected this time that the military work will not be limited to the villages that Al-Qaeda terrorists entered, but there's a high chance that the army will go way further after securing the villages fallen by the terrorists. Currently, Russian and in the past 2 days, Russian and Syrian warplanes also have been targeting the terrorist headquarters and supply lines in Idlib and in Idlib and Aleppo western countryside, along with the artillery and missile units, and inflicting heavy losses among the terrorists. The lines have been organized now among the forces of the Syrian army and the allied forces, together with advanced and advances currently underway on several fronts. Additional elite forces have been deployed to reinforce the front line, the front lines, and clear the areas of the from the Al-Nusra front and its allied forces. This moment is really critical for Aleppo, specifically the residents of Aleppo. People now, I'm getting calls from there, and my family is there. Many people now are shocked. Many people outside Aleppo are also are shocked why this is happening, how did this happen. We've seen this before. The amount of support that the terrorists are taking from Turkey, from Israel, from the US, this is all to pressure Syria. At this moment, we need to stay calm, trust the Syrian Arab Army and our allies who have never abandoned us at the moment.
Thanks a lot, Zebrahim Wahdi, joining us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. We were joined earlier by independent researcher and author Greg Simons from Sweden. He believes that the recent resurgence of terrorist groups in Syria is no coincidence.
There is no coincidence or accident in the timing. This seems to be taking place precisely at the moment when you have this so-called ceasefire, which I doubt Israel will honour anyway, because that's going against the statements of what they want to achieve. But coming back to Syria, I mean, Israel has been using terrorists in Syria for a long time now, and they've been providing them with medical services, all kinds of support. So what this seems to be is to spread and outsource the conflict elsewhere. I mean, in Lebanon, Israeli troops were dying. Here, you've got some terrorists will die. No one cares. I mean, this is designed to disrupt the alliance, which is against Israel. I don't see it come anything more. It's a distraction, which doesn't cost Israel any of their soldiers dead, but inflicts casualties.
Iran has once again reiterated its support for Syria as terror groups conduct new operations in the Arab country. Iran's foreign minister made the remarks during a phone call with his Syrian counterpart, Bassam Sabah. Abbas Araghchi said, "The resurgence of terrorist groups in Syria is a U.S.-Israeli plan following the Tel Aviv regime's defeat in Lebanon and Palestine." He said Tehran will continue supporting the Syrian government, nation, and army to fight terrorism and protect regional security and stability. For his part, Bassam Sabah said the Syrian government and people are standing against the terrorist groups with all their strength. The top diplomat said that they will fail to achieve their evil intentions. A senior Iranian diplomat has called on the European Union to end its, quote, irresponsible behavior towards international challenges. Deputy Foreign Minister for Legal and International Affairs, Qasem Gharibabadi, said the EU should abandon its self-centered behavior vis-a-vis issues and challenges of Europe and the world. Gharibabadi, who is also a member of Iran's negotiating team in Geneva, said Europe projects its own problems and mistakes onto others, including with regards to the conflict in Ukraine. He made the remarks following a Thursday meeting with Enrique Mora, European Union's deputy foreign policy chief. Gharibabadi said also that the UK, France, and Germany preach others on human rights while being complicit in Israel's genocide in Gaza. He also said Europe has failed to be a serious player regarding lifting anti-Iran sanctions. Iran is set to hold talks with UK, France, and Germany on Friday on a variety of issues, including Iran's nuclear program. At least 32 people have been killed as Israel intensifies its air and artillery strikes on residential areas across the war-racked Gaza Strip. Most of the fatalities were reported from the Al-Nusayrat refugee camp and Gaza City, where Israel's military has carried out deadly raids. Another Israeli attack also killed five members of a family in their home in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Meanwhile, authorities say over a million Palestinian children are suffering from malnutrition across Gaza. The health crisis is also rapidly deteriorating in the war-torn territory, with 34 hospitals being knocked out of service. The Israeli genocide has killed over 44,380 civilians so far, leaving nearly 105,000 others injured. The genocidal war on Gaza has shattered almost all aspects of a normal life in the blockaded territory, but the birth of a baby can alleviate Palestinian suffering and bring a ray of hope that Gazans will come back to normal life again. Our Gaza correspondent Abu Bakr Abed has been to a displacement camp in Deir al-Balah, providing us with a report on a Palestinian mother who celebrates the birth of her newborn baby.
A totally unusual moment of happiness in the face of extreme adversity. Aysen has just arrived in the world but doesn't know whether she will live another day. And her family's displacement camp, her mother, who lost her only son, along with other moms and children, gathered to celebrate the moment, a sense of sheer euphoria she hopes to last forever. As the cake reads, Aysen's family hopes to find light with her daughter in the midst of complete darkness and bleakness. The other for two children, Maya and Yazan, 13 years old, who the war severely traumatized and deprived of their basic rights, and the mother embracing her newborn baby, whose eyes haven't yet opened to the injustice of this world, wishes to come back home and escape the incessant horror it chasing her family.
There is a sense of joy here. However, it is not complete as we are in the midst of a war and have been forced to leave our homes. Our lives are simply too difficult. Prices are really high. I have a newborn baby and thinking about how to provide her with milk, diapers, clothes, nourishment. Everything is outrageously expensive here. I even suffered from hunger during pregnancy and childbirth, but I'm very grateful to God for having this girl after my only son was killed.
We've had a great time celebrating our birthdays. I'm eager to return to my home in Gaza City. We wish to return to our hometowns and schools. This war will eventually come to an end, God willing.
Newborn Aysen and the twin children, Maya and Yazan, don't know if they will live for the next days. But the war in Gaza, which killed more than 43,000 Palestinians, mostly children and women, and wounded over 105,000 others, has never changed the resilience and steadfastness of the Palestinian people. And the happiness we've just lived today with those people is a reflection of eternal hope they have been always clinging on to. Abu Bakr Abed, Deir al-Balah, Gaza.
Hamas has called on popular movements worldwide to enhance their activities in solidarity with the Gaza Strip in order to compel Israel to cease its genocidal war on the besieged territory. The Palestinian resistance movement stressed in a statement that all tools must be used until the end of the Israeli onslaught. Hamas urged all global parties and unions and Muslim and free countries to hold pro-Palestine marches, and also demanded Palestinians in the occupied territories intensify all forms of resistance. The group's statement was issued on the occasion of the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Hamas said the designation by the United Nations serves as a reminder of the urgent need for effective action to stop the Israeli aggression. An Israeli minister has once again called for re-establishing settlements in the Gaza Strip. The regime's minister of housing described the move as a response to the arrest warrants issued by the International Criminal Court for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and ousted War Minister Yoav Gallant. Yitzhak Goldknopf posted a photograph of himself on social media looking at a map of potential settlement sites in Gaza. Israel evacuated its settlements and military presence from Gaza in 2005. However, in recent months, Israeli ministers and lawmakers have renewed calls to establish settlements. It has drawn strong Palestinian opposition and widespread regional condemnation. Israel has also been expanding its settlement activity in the occupied West Bank. The settlements are illegal under international law. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
News of ICC arrest warrants for Israeli regime leaders was welcomed, but several expressed it was just a single step on a long road ahead. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and former War Minister Yoav Gallant have emboldened organizers to push harder for an end to the war on Gaza, anti-war activists and pro-Palestinian advocates told Middle East Eye. At the same time, they say the warrants are a grossly inadequate development given the carnage still unfolding in Gaza. With the death toll in Gaza set to be anywhere between 44,000 and 186,000 or even more, activists in the U.S. said the development would be a step forward in making Israel a pariah regime, though the priority remained to find a way to hold the flow of weapons to Israel, which the U.S. government refuses to do. Recently, human rights groups were scrambling to respond to a failed Senate vote led by Bernie Sanders to block new arms sales to Israel the previous night, as well as to the other development later in the morning that saw Congress vote in favor of Resolution 9495, which, if passed by the Senate, would make it easier to criminalize and target charities and pro-Palestinian nonprofits in the U.S. Beth Miller, political director of Jewish Voice for Peace, called the bill a five-alarm fire for anyone who seeks to protect free speech, civil society, and democracy. Hours before the ICC's announcement, the Zionist regime killed close to 100 Palestinians in separate airstrikes, in what signaled Israel's intent to continue its devastating bombing campaign in northern Gaza. While the prospect of a ceasefire seems more remote than ever, organizers said the warrants would go a long way towards influencing the world to isolate the Israeli regime for its ongoing crimes. Hatam Abu Obeideh, an organizer with U.S. Palestinian Community Network, told Middle East Eye, "Israel, across the world now, even in the United States, is being seen as a pariah, racist, white supremacist, settler, colonialist, Zionist regime that it is. I think that it is what this represents, the continuation of Israel's isolation in the world. I would love to see them come outside the confines of their bunkers and challenge these warrants," the Chicago-based man added. While activists welcomed the news of warrants, several expressed a measured and sober response to the development's significance. Abdullah Akel, a longtime political organizer based in New York City, said the warrants for Netanyahu, while notable, would once again distinguish those who respected the rule of law and those who would find ways to disavow it. For months, the U.S. regime has found ways to shield the Zionist regime, refusing to support a ceasefire or an arms embargo, even as the International Court of Justice said Israel's actions in Gaza amount to genocide. Akel said it was inconceivable that American names could be excluded from the charge sheets. "Where are the rest of the arrest warrants for the people who were just as complicit as Netanyahu? The people that were just as complicit like President Joe Biden, like Vice President Kamala Harris, and the list goes on and on with Secretary of State Antony Blinken and others," Akel asked rhetorically, adding, "We want an arrest warrant for Biden. The Biden administration made sure to sign off on the weapons deals. They made sure to play the backdoor conversation." Akel's cynicism of the ICC was echoed by other organizations and activists' measures reactions to the warrants. In his statement, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee's Abed Ayyub said the warrants for Netanyahu and former War Minister Yoav Gallant represented a critical step toward accountability for grave violations of international law. "The Biden administration's complicit backing of Israel has fueled this genocide and violated international norms, isolating the U.S. from the global community and undermining its credibility. The United States' refusal to hold perpetrators accountable sends a dangerous message of impunity." Ayyub said the ICC's decision to issue warrants reaffirmed the principle that no one is above the law. Other groups, like the Jewish Youth-led group, If Not Now, said the warrants for Netanyahu Gallant was a step in the right direction towards holding them accountable for their role in crimes against humanity. The group said the warrants won't bring back the Palestinians martyred, but it's a step in the right direction. The group said in a statement, "We hope it may bring a measure of justice and enable the world to avert catastrophes like this again. Political leaders in the U.S. should support the ICC's efforts instead of threatening, sanctioning, and delegitimizing the court." However, Akel said he was skeptical about the ICC's decision to issue warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant. The Zionist regime war on Gaza has ushered in the most significant anti-war movements in the U.S. since the Vietnam War. For the past year, hundreds of thousands have taken to the streets in several American cities to protest against the war and lead disruptions at train stations, on highways and bridges, and even within government buildings, in an attempt to draw attention to the carnage being unleashed in Gaza. In the spring of 2024, students set up encampments at more than 100 campuses to pressure their universities to disclose and divest from Israel and to call for an end to the Zionist regime's war on Gaza. Universities responded by calling in the police to clear up the protest sites, censoring students and faculty as portraying student protest against Israel's war on Gaza as anti-Semitic. On the streets, too, protesters have been met with increasing police brutality and restrictions. Tensions are already boiling, with President-elect Donald Trump promising to up the ante when he takes office in January 2025. Akel from New York City says the movement for Palestine would not hinge on Netanyahu being imprisoned for his crimes or not. However, the call by the ICC to have him arrested and tried does help, he says. I think it does not mean that our calls for divestment are over, because we know that it isn't just Netanyahu. We are looking for something larger, and so Netanyahu is really just the start, and our work is long from over until Palestine is, of course, free and until the land has returned. Akel added, the goal is to continue this work now more than ever, now that more people are watching it.
Quran Quest on Iran Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Quran Quest on Iran Radio. With me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, Sayyid Salman Naghavi. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you back in the studio, Sayyid. It's actually a couple of weeks or sessions that you are answering my Quranic questions regarding Surah Al-Fil or Chapter the Elephant. And, before we move on with our questions regarding this small chapter of the Quran, let's listen to the verses of this chapter, and then we'll be back with our program, Quran Quest, on Iran Radio. Stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
ألم تر كيف فعل ربك بأصحاب الفيل.
Have you not considered, O Muhammad, how your Lord dealt with the companions of the elephant?
أَلَمْ يَجْعَلْ كَيْدَهُمْ فِي تَضْلِيلٍ.
Did he not make their plan into misguidance?
وَأَرْسَلَ عَلَيْهِمْ طَيْرًا أَبَابِيلَ.
And he sent against them birds in flocks.
تَرْمِيهِمْ بِحِجَارَةٍ مِّن سِجِّيلٍ.
Striking them with stones of hard clay.
فَجَعَلَهُمْ كَعَصْفٍ مَأْكُولٍ.
And he made them like eaten straw.
Back to the program, Quran Quest on Iran Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and Sayyid Salman Naghavi, my guest speaker in the studio, answering my Quranic questions, especially in this episode, as a kind of continuation of the previous episodes, focusing on chapter The Elephant or Surah Al-Fil. Sayyid, last time I asked you a question regarding what kind of birds actually was mentioned by the Holy Quran in this chapter, and you said Ababil, and you talked about it in length. And now I think it's good to talk about the kind of stones that they tried to pelt down, you know, on the Abraha's army, right? With their elephants, destroying and demolishing all of his army. What kind of stone was it? Because the Quran mentioned it's Sajil. So what is Sajil? Do we have any kind of precedence with this? In the Arabic language, of course.
Sajil may have been different meanings, but basically it shows that, again, it may be clay which is hardened clay, dried clay, or it could be a pebble, or could be maybe some translators in English talk about it's some sort of dried rock made from lava from the volcanoes when the lava comes out and it becomes dried. Maybe it is some sort of that special stone. But it, again, we have to emphasize the fact it's not a very miraculous thing. It's not a very special stone which the Quran is mentioning. Rather, it wants to just say that it's a normal piece of stone and which was used. It was this, maybe the size of a small pea, not a very big stone. Because the animals, the birds that were lifting it up, they were not also big birds. They were normal, small birds who could just, you know, manage small stones, very small stones in their beak and in their claws. So basically it's not very important. It's not significant what type of spell. Was it a stone from heaven or something like that? No, nothing miraculous. Normal stone. Just Allah Almighty wants to emphasize again here that it was normal, a normal bird, a normal stone, which had this great, you know,
Miraculous result,
exactly. So, of course, even small pellets, pellet-like stones, pea-sized, when they drop from a very high altitude, of course, they will create a great impact on anyone down there. So, therefore, the result was that it pierced through the body of the animals and the human beings. It went from one side and came out the other side. And, you know, made them fully, you know, perforated. The whole body was completely, of the animal or the human being, was completely, you know, made into small, what you can say, perforated-like things, which leaves just something which is, as is mentioned, kasfim makul. It was something like which has been chewed up as a result of that action. So, I mean, the important thing is the stone which is being mentioned here. Or is it made of clay? Or is it pebble? It's not important. The important thing is that it is a small, normal thing which was picked up by the birds. Of course, this is the miraculous thing. The birds went in. They picked up those stones from somewhere.
Yes.
Again, we don't find any mention of any specific place from where the birds picked up those stones. Certainly, they would have gone to some place on the earth. It wasn't something from the heavens. It wasn't something we could say, oh, the angels came down in the form of birds. That's not implied anywhere.
Yes. You know, a long time ago, Sayyid, when humans actually have not achieved so many academic achievements, or which we call it advancement, basically, maybe man could not think of it as something like, because, you know, they think of some small stones with so much power in it, actually, or the energy has been released. But now, with all kinds of technology and the advancement today, man has, you know, achieved so far in this modern day and age, maybe they can find out or discover that, for example, however small it was, or although small it was, it had, for example, so much density in it or something like that, according to the physical laws or the science of physics, at least. It could be accounted for academically speaking or scientifically speaking, right?
There are some people, some commentators of the Quran, who want to, you know, give some scientific reasoning for example, how compact it was, how the formation of the stone was.
Mm.
There was some special, you know, composition of the stone.
Right.
Yes, sometimes it is is it possible for a small thing to make such a great impact? Or maybe sometimes it is mentioned that some say that because it's there in the narrations that at that day, as a result of that, or in the same year, there was a plague or some sort of plague, mm-hmm, which took place in that year in Yemen, and people became affected and afflicted with that, like typhoid maybe, something, mm-hmm, some sort of, you know. And there's a reasoning, there's a speculation that these stones contains the microbes which carried the, for example, this plague, or the viruses were carried by those stones, and those people who got hit there, even when if some of them survived and went back to Yemen, like Ibrahim himself, he survived that event, but he went back to Yemen and passed away immediately after that.
Mm-hmm. But you said that those stones had the power of piercing through their bodies.
Yeah, yes.
So the virus couldn't do that, basically,
people, they are, as I said, when we want to speculate about what happened, mm-hmm, how it happened, why it happened, and then you collect these things of these circumstantial things that, mm-hmm, there was a plague also there coming. So sometimes you try to bring these together and say possibly that was the reason.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to say maybe simply the Quran just wants to say simple stones, simple birds, they come together with the will of Allah Almighty.
Yes.
And to protect the Holy Kaaba and to destroy the enemy.
Yes, exactly. The means were ordinary, but the result was miraculous.
So we don't have to go into those very great details, scientific details, because we sometimes unnecessarily want to, you know, explain everything, especially Islam and religion and Quran in scientific terms. And that has its downsides because, as you know, the Quran is not a book of science.
Yes.
Because we also say you can't, there's no comparison with the Quran with any other subject,
yes,
even philosophy.
Yes.
It talks about philosophy, it talks about science, it talks about many things, historical events, but it's none of them. It's not a book of history, it's not a book of science, it's not a book of anthropology. So simply a book of guidance,
yes,
spiritual guidance.
There are some domains or planes where mind and science cannot work, right? As long as the physical realities are involved or material things are involved, there is room actually for scientific explanation, right? Science could account for some of the events according to the capacity of science and the scientists, of course, and their technologies. But when it comes to metaphysical things, I think, it's very difficult for the science to have any kind of justification for that.
Exactly. Science does not have any role to play in things which are beyond physical
realm.
The physical realm.
Yes.
Again, when we talk about the metaphysical issues, it's not necessarily, the metaphysical is not necessarily something beyond the physical realm.
Mm-hmm.
The metaphysical, the philosophy that we talk about encompasses even the physical realm.
Mm.
Because metaphysics, in our understanding, covers all aspects of existence.
Right.
Whether physical or otherwise.
Yes.
But science is limited to the physical realm, and it can't go beyond that.
Exactly.
And here, even in this, the verse that we're talking about, the chapter we're talking about, we see the physics being played out. I mean, the physics of the stone coming from a high altitude with a velocity.
With gravity, velocity.
Velocity, gravity is putting it down. So physical laws are playing here, mm-hmm, are working here. as they should.
But the result was metaphysical.
It was physical. The result was also physical. The people who died, they died physically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their bodies were pierced. The only miraculous thing which we see is the birds coming together, guided by some sort of inspiration or some sort of, divine intervention through which they go and collect the stones.
Okay.
And they come and they come into the form of a flock and they attack the enemy. Mm-hmm. So this is everything happening.
Thank you very much, Sayyid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back quickly or momentarily and continue our program Quran Quest on Iran Radio. Stay with us.
You are listening to Quran Quest on Iran Radio.
Back to the program Quran Quest on Iran Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sayyid Salman Naghavi, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, my guest speaker in the studio, explaining and answering my questions regarding chapter The Elephant or Suratul Fil. Well, my next question, Sayyid, very quickly, if I may squeeze in here at the end of this episode, what was the outcome of the attempts to attack the Kaaba, as described in the chapter?
So as a result of the events that took place, the flocking of the birds, and the whole enemy was wiped out. I mean, no one was able to, because they had, number one, started to come upon the Kaaba from the hilltops.
Right.
They wanted to, come down, and they just wanted to destroy the Kaaba because all the people had fled, gone away.
Mm-hmm.
And even the grandfather of the Holy Prophet, Abdul Muttalib, he
yes.
had also gone into a safe place,
mm-hmm.
and he was just waiting for something to happen, and he had asked his son, one of his sons, to go to the hilltop, the mountain top, and go and see what's happening. And when he saw the swarm coming the flock of birds coming, he told Abdul Muttalib, and Abdul Muttalib was then he was relieved.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the animals, the army of Afra wanted to come down, but their horses, their elephants would not, come down.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the swarm started coming and the pebbles came down, the stones came down, they ran away. They started to run away. And every animal nearly was wiped out
mm-hmm.
through this, and they were made into, completely pierced and completely perforated, and
the whole army was basically destroyed.
Destroyed.
Okay, thank you very much, Sayyid. That was Sayyid Salman Naghavi, my guest speaker in the studio with me, answering my Quranic questions regarding chapter The Elephant or Suratul Fil. Of course, we haven't finished discussing about this chapter, and inshallah in the upcoming episodes we continue to do so. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Quran Quest, the program that answers your Quranic questions.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The story of death, destruction, stress and trauma is the everyday story of the Palestinian people who are being suffered by the Zionist thugs for 76 years. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Electronic Intifada wrote, the first missile the Israeli occupation forces fired at the Abu Nasr family home in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza, on October 28, hit the stairwell. Around 300 members of the extended Abu Nasr family had taken shelter in the 10 apartments of the five-story building, and the stairwell was the only escape route. After the first missile was fired at 10 p.m. that night, the majority of people in the building could not escape. When the second missile was fired at 4 a.m. the next morning, only 15 members of the extended family survived, 10 children and 5 men. Hani Abu Nasr is 39 years old. His wife and sons were killed in the Zionist regime attacks. He said, the occupation forces fired a reconnaissance missile at the building's staircase on October 28 at 10 p.m., blocking a critical escape route. Unaware that further strikes would follow, only my brother, who lived on the ground floor and did not need to use the stairs, managed to escape with his wife and children. The remaining family members and I were trapped and unable to evacuate, so we called civil defense and ambulance services only to be told that no assistance could reach us at that time. We gathered our belongings, hoping to seek help at dawn. Tragically, the occupation forces struck again, shattering that hope. He said, the occupation aircraft attacked the building with missiles from an F-16 on October 29th at 4 a.m., reducing the house to a pile of rubble. When the airstrike happened, I didn't hear or feel anything. I woke up and found myself on the roof of a building next to ours. It was morning and I could hear people screaming and the sound of neighbors pulling victims from our house and the nearby houses that had also been damaged by the airstrike, including the Ode family's home. My arm was bleeding and the pain was excruciating. My ribcage hurt and I felt as though it was fractured. I couldn't speak or scream, and there was no one around to see me or help. Looking around, I saw stones scattered across the surface where I lay. I tried to crawl on my back to the edge of the roof and began throwing stones to get someone's attention. After the third attempt, I finally heard someone say, "There is someone here." Muhammad Abu Nasr, 29, is Hani Abu Nasr's brother, mentioned above by Hani as the family member who escaped with his wife and children after the first Zionist regime strike. He said, when the explosion happened and the outer wall of the building collapsed into my home, I knew we were in danger and had to get out. I jumped over the wall and saw that the building's staircase had been destroyed, leaving no way for my family to escape without the help of civil defense or ambulance crews. I didn't know whether to save myself and my family or stay and face the death with the rest of them. Muhammad jumped over the wall and his wife had to throw their children over the wall to him. They fled to a neighbor's house, unable to travel long distances at night with quadcopters patrolling the skies. He said, I didn't sleep that whole night, thinking about my parents, my brothers, my nieces and nephews. How could I leave them and run away? Was I really a coward, a traitor? Thoughts tormented me and I couldn't tell whether I had done the right thing or not. Eventually, I fell asleep, but only for 10 minutes. I woke to the sound of an explosion louder than anything I had ever heard. It felt like an earthquake had shaken an entire area, with the ground trembling violently and parts of the walls in the house I'd taken refuge in collapsing. I realized then that the sound came from the targeting of my family's house. I could hear my family's voices screaming and pleading for help. They were saying there were many wounded and there were martyrs. The pain was unbearable, made worse by the fact that I couldn't go out. Everyone told me not to, warning that I'd be putting myself in danger. I had to wait until morning because the Israeli Air Force was patrolling the skies. I sat there, listening to my family's cries, powerless to help. Mohammed recovered 117 bodies from the rubble and said that he believed an additional 130 were still buried under the rubble. Aida Abu Nasr, 15, survived, yet all of her immediate family was murdered. She said, "We lived on the fifth floor, and when the reconnaissance missile struck on October 28, my mother, my sister, and I were injured. We had been sleeping next to each other in the living room. The rest of my family was unharmed, but they couldn't do anything to help us because no one could get out. Our injuries weren't severe at first, but we were bleeding, and I had terrible pain in my legs. They shouted and called for help, but no one responded. Those who were uninjured began preparing bags and gathering essential items, hoping to leave in the morning. When the missiles from the F-16 hit at 4 a.m., I didn't hear anything, but I never lost consciousness. At first, a thick black cloud blocked my vision, but gradually everything cleared. I found myself between my mother and my sister. The section we were on was tilted and about to collapse. I survived because I was on the top floor, but those injured on the lower floors continued to bleed out, unable to be rescued. My mother was clinging to my right arm, and my sister Rania was holding on to my left arm, afraid of falling. They were both injured, and I kept asking, "Are you okay?" They could only gesture with their eyes. They couldn't speak. My leg was trapped under a block of concrete, and I was screaming and begging for help while my other foot was trapped under the rubble. Whenever I tried to free it, my mother held on to me even tighter, terrified of falling. She said, "I stayed still, holding my position to reassure them. Then I suddenly felt her hand slip from my arm. I turned to look and saw that she had died. And my pregnant sister on the other side had passed away before her without me even noticing. I kept trying to free my foot until after several attempts, I finally succeeded. By then, morning had come and I was limping because of my injured foot, walking over the remains of my brothers, mother, and father, shouting, 'Help me, help me.' Aida was taken to Al-Auda Hospital on a cart. Rescue teams tried to recover what they could of her family, but they only retrieved her mother and sister. Aida was eventually transferred from Al-Auda Hospital to Al-Helu Hospital.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, the Syrian army says it has repelled a major terrorist group's offensive on the city of Aleppo and inflicted heavy losses on them. Iran has reiterated its support for Syria, saying that the resurgence of terrorist groups there is a U.S.-Israeli plan following their defeats in Lebanon and Palestine. And also, Israel presses ahead with